It's 12:06, and you're tuned to WBOY for Health 360 here on 89.1 FM. I'm your host, Sarah D'Elia. If you'd like to join the conversation today, give us a call at 260-452-1185. You can always email us at middaymatters@nipr.fm or post on our Facebook page. And I'd like to introduce my new co-host, Dr. Peter Rothman, who is board certified in pediatrics and allergy. He's practiced adult and pediatric allergy and asthma for 35 years. He did for with the Fort Wayne Allergy and Asthma Consultants here in town. And he's currently a volunteer clinical assistant professor of pediatrics at Indiana University School of Medicine. Welcome, Dr. Rothman.
Thank you, Sarah, and I'm very pleased to be here. Today, given that it's Halloween, we're going to be interviewing Dr. Kevin Wright, a pediatric dentist with the Fort Wayne Dental Group, and we're going to talk about the effects of sugar overload on children's dental health. With Halloween and the upcoming holiday seasons, parents tend to relax their food restrictions, and we tend to have a bit of a free-for-all when it comes to sweets and candies for the next 3 months. And Dr. Wright, first of all, how do sugars and candies cause dental enamel breakdown, tooth decay, leading to cavities?
First of all, Peter, Dr. Peter, thanks for the invitation to come in and talk with you today. The action or the mode of action for the cavity formation is the bacteria that live in all of our mouths use the sugars in the candies, pops, juices, whatever we may be ingesting. And we're talking about candy today. And they use that carbohydrates as a food stuff, and then they secrete an acid, and that acid that they secrete is actually what demineralizes the enamel of our teeth that causes the tooth decay.
And what types of candies really do cause the most tooth enamel damage?
Well, the candies that are in our mouth the longest, the chewy, sticky candies that adhere to our teeth, taffies, caramels, items such as that, and also the candies, the lozenge-type candies that we suck on that have a lower pH or a higher acid content, those also are harder on our teeth because generally they're in our mouths longer.
And these hard candies can even crack teeth and affect appliances, fillings?
Definitely. This, in our office at least, and I'm pretty sure it's probably in every office around the city, this time of year around Halloween, and actually Halloween through the New Year's is the time we see most of our broken dental appliances and our dental restorations. These candies that are hard, that are chewed on, can be very, very tough on our adult teeth, and even tougher on our baby teeth, which are not made quite as sturdy as our adult teeth are.
And enamel tends to be irreplaceable. It's a very hard tissue, but of the body, but it is irreplaceable.
At this point, a lot of research going on that, but at this point, irreplaceable. Once you've lost it, you can only try to maintain what you have back.
Dr. Kevin, what would you recommend for parents? I mean, their kids are going to eat candy regardless if it's Halloween or not, but especially during Halloween, they're more likely to eat large sums of it. It's hard to tell your kid no, but what would you recommend if a parent was coming in and saying, I can't, you know, I know my kid's going to eat Halloween candy. What should I do? Should I try and tell them no altogether, or is a little bit okay?
Sarah, that's a great question, and I believe in moderation. I believe in moderation of the diet, and in this instance, in the candy intake. There is some times better than others that we can eat candy. Right after a meal, when the mouth has been active and saliva is bathing our teeth, that can help neutralize some of the acid in the sugar from the sugars that we're getting. Also, you know, one of the things we talked about before is, you know, chocolate, good old-fashioned chocolate is, you know, one of the candies. It's probably, of all the candies, the least harmful to our teeth. Huh. You chew it, it's gone.
Uh-huh.
Okay, the pH is not as bad as some of the others, and it's not in our mouths an extended period of time.
Mm-hmm. So I was going to ask what kind of, if you had to recommend a candy to hand out on Halloween, it would be chocolate?
Chocolate.
Okay.
It usually works for all the mothers, too.
And we have a situation on Halloween evening where the kids tend to bring back large amounts. And there's been a debate that as to whether children should be allowed to binge and just eat it all up, get it over with, brush your teeth, floss your teeth, and go to bed, or what we've seen our children do through the years, hoard it in their bedrooms and eat a little bit here and a little bit there randomly over the next 2 weeks. What's the current feeling about binging versus hoarding?
Well, when we get in a hoarding situation, you know, the kids, they're just allowed free access to that candy. And when that happens, you get a lot more exposures to these candies that starts cascading this whole process of the acid production and the demineralization of the teeth. So I tend to believe more in the binging and less in the hoarding, because the number of exposures for anything we eat or drink is one of the most important factors in the health of our teeth. Mm-hmm. The more these bacteria get foodstuffs, the more acid they're going to secrete, the harder it's going to be on our teeth.
Mm-hmm. So I think Dr. Wright also mentioned to me that it's better to eat 5 candy bars at once than eat one candy bar every 4 hours.
Correct. Hmm. That is definitely correct as far as our teeth are concerned. since we're just talking about teeth, you can get into the whole thing about, you know, unneeded calories and mm-hmm. that, but we'll just stick with the teeth.
Okay. 260-452-1185. You can also send us an email at middaymatters@nipr.fm or post on our Facebook page if you have any questions or comments. We're talking about dental care on this Halloween edition of Health 360. And to do that, I have my co-host, Dr. Peter Rothman, as well as Dr. Kevin Wright, who is a pediatric dentist here in town. I wanted to ask before we get on too much further, if you're a parent and your child is complaining of toothaches, how long before you need to take them into the dentist?
Just whenever you can get to the phone.
Okay.
If they're complaining, it's time. If
okay.
it's, it, you know, I'm sure Dr. Peter saw it in his practice, and it happens in dentistry. We do see phantom growing pains and some phantom pain that, you know, parents say that, well, the child's been complaining for 2-3 weeks off and on, and then we do an exam in the office and we just can't find anything. Now, that might be what's going on, mm-hmm. or probably there is some problems.
Gotcha.
There is some problems. So whether the child is 12 months old, mm-hmm. and it's really reacting to food or drink, and it's not too early.
Okay.
It's not too early.
We've got a caller on line one. Margaret, welcome to Health 360.
Hello. I would like to add a little to the Halloween candy debate.
Sure.
Many years ago, when my son, who's now almost 30, was a child, about 6 or 7. Mm-hmm. He was going through some food allergy problems. And it just happened to coincide with a visit to our dentist. And his wonderful hygienist, Susan Chiaquinta, told me that her family has the great pumpkin visit every Halloween night. And after trick-or-treating, the kids put their candy out, and the great pumpkin comes and takes that candy and leaves them a gift in its place. And it's a tradition that my kids just loved. So parents who, you know, are struggling with the candy monster might want to consider that one.
That's great, Margaret. Thanks for sharing.
You're welcome.
That's a wonderful point. And it has been suggested that when the children bring their candy home, they eat what they wish, and the excess candy may be turned in for tokens, stickers, or small change, but disposed of in some polite way. And the great pumpkin idea is wonderful. And this has definitely been recommended to prevent the hoarding of candy and irregular random eating that we've talked about.
Mm-hmm. Do you recommend, Dr. Kevin, that kids brush more this time of year when they're going to be eating a lot of a lot of chewy foods, a lot of chewy candies?
Most definitely. We at our office recommend that any time after any ingestion of food, we should brushing and flossing. And that Sarah brings up a good point, and which we had discussed in private, that even if you can't get to a toothbrush or mm-hmm. floss, a stick of sugarless gum has been proven to be an agent that helps fight, helps neutralize the acid.
Uh-huh.
The chemical in the sugarless gum, xylitol, has actually been found to be an agent that helps fight tooth decay, and it's used in a lot of European countries that don't have fluoride in their mm-hmm. water. So mm-hmm. If we can't get to the toothbrush, but we can get to a stick of sugarless gum, that will actually be an aid to help fighting tooth decay.
Okay. And drinking water, if you can,
most
right
definitely.
After, too, just to wash it out. Because mm-hmm. just as saliva washes off as well as neutralizes the water, at mm-hmm. least can cleanse.
And we have Hank on line two. Hank, welcome to Midday Matters.
Thank you. Yes, I would like to ask the doctor, I'm not a smoker myself, but, you know, I do work in a factory and have some friends that that chew. And I was told way back when by someone that some of this chew stuff has like little glass particles in it that kind of pit your gums, and that's how the juice kind of gets in there to make it tasteful.
Well, Hank, we're not really talking about chew today. We're kind of focusing on sweets and health as far as candy goes. But I'm sure, Dr. Kevin, you would, as a dentist, would recommend not using chewing tobacco. That's probably leads to not great things for our gums and teeth, I imagine.
Yeah, it's even though it's not in my area of expertise, just generally, smokeless tobacco is very harmful to all the oral tissues in our mouth and can lead to a lot of destruction of your gums, of your bones, mm-hmm. all the way up into oral cancer. So it's definitely not anything that I recommend anybody get involved in.
260-452-1185 is the number to call if you have a question about dental care. Particularly, we're talking about candy. It is Halloween, so if you have any concerns, if you're a parent, about what your kids should be chewing on tonight, please do give us a call, or you can always email us at middaymatters@nipr.fm, and feel free to like us on Facebook and post on our Facebook page with any questions or comments that you might have. So we've talked about the candy, that chocolate is kind of the passable thing. Do you recommend handing out fruit or something a little bit more unconventional? The problem is, I know people are fearful of taking things from strangers, and especially if they're not in wrappers.
Right. For, you know, all of our thoughts on Halloween should first go to safety and mm-hmm. the safety of the children. And if it's not in a wrapper, it's someone who had kids himself, I wouldn't have them eat it.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't have them eat it.
Okay.
There's all sorts of things that can be handed out: pencils, erasers, any matter of trinkets. So I think those are viable alternatives.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Okay.
Another question that has come up is, at what age in a small child, when do we begin regular dental cleanings and dental care? Obviously, toothbrushing starts when there are teeth, but when can you, and when can flossings be started with small children?
I can go with the American Academy of Pediatric Dentistry on this one. There's has been a program for the last 8 to 10 years for a push to start seeing one-year-olds to get something going called the dental home, and really get them just growing up as the dentist, as a place they've just always gone to, not somewhere that they just popped in once at 5 and came again at 8 when they had a problem, but something that they grew up with. So mm-hmm. our recommendation in the academy is around the first birthday.
We're going to take a short break on Health 360 here at WBOI. But if you have a question or a comment, then you're dying to let us know, please do give us a call, 260-452-1185. We're talking about pediatric dentistry right now because it is Halloween. And if you have a question or concern about what your child is going to be ingesting this evening and how that's going to affect their teeth, we'd love to hear from you. You can also post on our Facebook page or send us a note at middaymatters@nipr.fm.
Where do you go for rich conversation on the topics that matter most? The radio is more responsive than the water cooler, and we take your calls. I'm Neil Conan. If you're talking about it, we're talking about it. Join us for provocative talk on the issues you really care about. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Tune in weekdays at 2 here on WBOI, Northeast Indiana Public Radio.
You help pay for public education in Indiana, but from the Capitol to the classroom, the payback isn't always clear. You can find out how the state's policy impacts your family in our new State Impact Indiana Project, a local national collaboration between Indiana public broadcasting stations and NPR. You can hear the stories during Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and Weekend Edition on NIPR, and dig deeper with a click on the State Impact logo at nipr.fm.
On Fresh Air, you can hear interviews that make you see the world in a new way.
Every drink of water you take, every pot of coffee you make is dinosaur pee because it's all been through the kidneys of a Tyrannosaurus Rex or an Apatosaurus many, many times because all the water we have is all the water we have ever had.
You just never know what you'll learn next on Fresh Air. Join us.
Fresh Air weekdays at 1 on WBOI.
Support for this program on WBOI is provided by Lutheran Hospital, serving patients and families with Northern Indiana's only heart and kidney transplant center. Information at lutheranhealth.net.
Welcome back to Health 360 Midday Matters here on WBOY. If you're just joining us, we're talking about pediatric dentistry because it is Halloween. And if you have any questions or comments about different kinds of foods that your kids are going to be eating today on Halloween and how that's going to affect their teeth, give us a call at 260-452-1185. MiddayMatters@nipr.fm is our email account, or you can give us a post or a comment at our Facebook page. I'm Sarah D'Elia, joined this afternoon by my co-host Dr. Peter Rothman as well as Dr. Kevin Wright, and we have a call on line one. Bill, welcome to Health 360.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
What's your question?
My question is, after we get home, we've eaten all our candy and we're washing it down, I'm on a well, and my question is, are they getting the right fluoride? Are they getting the right things that they need on a well water? And that's my question. Thank you.
About a one-third of the wells in Northeast Indiana have fluoride in the groundwater. A lot of people aren't familiar with that. So that is worth getting your well checked for the fluoride. And any pediatric dentist and maybe some dentists in town can help you with that. Because, fluoride in the water, I mean, it's been proven for 40, 50 years now. It takes 50% of the cavities out of the population.
Wow. So if you're losing out on that from your natural water supply, then that's something that you should look into.
Yeah, because there's a chewable tablet that we prescribe for kids for fluoride replacement.
Oh, excellent. Thank you so much, Bill, for calling Health 360 and being a part of today's show. Again, 260-452-1185 or middaymatters@nipr.fm. Way to get in touch with us with any questions.
Dr. Wright, I wanted to ask you that while pacifiers have been recently recommended once again for possibly preventing sudden infant death syndrome in small infants, what is the long-term effect of pacifiers on the child's orthodonture, and how long should they or shouldn't they be using them?
That's a great question and a great point, that if it does turn out that these pacifiers in the younger children are helping with SIDS, then with the sudden infant death syndrome, I think that's tremendous, and I would recommend it then to all parents. 2 years old seems to be the point that we start making our push in the office for decreasing and then stopping the pacifier. When we're sucking on the pacifier, it does have an effect where it's moving the bones or molding and forming the bones around that pacifier, and it's actually changing the dentition, causing what we call an open bite. And we've seen in our office that around 2 years old, if we can get that pacifier stopped, then we have a natural correction of that problem in most instances.
260-452-1185 if you have a question for Health 360 this day. We have just about 3 minutes left in this first half of our show. We're talking about pediatric dentistry, and here to do that we have Dr. Kevin Wright, who is with the Fort Wayne Dental Group. Any last words for parents to keep in mind for Halloween this Wednesday as their kids go trick-or-treating? Any last reminders that we can provide for our listeners?
Sarah, I think that moderation and supervision is the important thing here. I do believe kids need to be kids, and we can't take everything away from them, but there is certainly things that we can do that we've talked about today that can be some prevention for the acid formation that we talked about, and the tooth decay, the decalcification of the enamel.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, go ahead.
I think a suggestion has been made: give them a big full meal before they go trick or treating, so they won't be hungry or craving too much afterwards when they get their candy. And then again, remember the point: let them binge, but get it over with, and brushing, flossing, try to prevent hoarding. And if you want to take the big pumpkin approach and have it traded in for toys, goodies, stickers, pencils, even small change, everyone would be happy. But it's the hoarding, and watch the, as Dr. Wright pointed out, the hard candy, the gummy candies, and the acidic sour candies.
Well, Dr. Kevin Wright, thank you so much for joining us today on Health 360.
Thank you very much, Sarah.
We're going to take a short break here at Health 360, but we'll be back with more. We're going to be switching gears and talking about sleep disorders, sleep terrors, and nightmares. So do stick around for that. After this short break, we'll be back with more information on that. 260-452-1185 or NIPR.FM is the way to get in touch with us, and we'll be back in just a few moments.
Republican Alan West has called House Democrats members of the Communist Party.
Take your message of enslaving the entrepreneurial spirit of the American people somewhere else.
And he's in a tough re-election bid despite moving to a more conservative district. The battle for a Florida seat and control of the House later on All Things Considered from NPR News. All Things Considered airs weekday afternoons at 4 on WBOI, Northeast Indiana Public Radio.
Good afternoon. I'm Katie Anderson with WBOY News. Lawmakers want to extend the emergency regulations for outdoor stage equipment that were created following last year's State Fair stage collapse. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports.
A bill passed last legislative session put in place temporary regulations to be enforced through 2013 while giving emergency rulemaking power to the Indiana Department of Homeland Security and the Building Safety Commission. A legislative study committee was tasked this summer with recommending a more permanent solution. The committee Tuesday opted instead to recommend extending the current regulations until 2016 and give the state agencies more time to gather input and further develop the regulations. Committee co-chair Bob Cherry says the General Assembly would still be able to make additional changes if it's unhappy with the state agencies.
We really want to make sure they're working with the locals on this, and if it's not, we will hear it from our constituents that it's not working, and we'll be back.
Homeland Security Director Joe Wainscott says the process that has taken place over the last year has been an educational one.
If nothing else, there's been a lot of good come out of this process because more people are aware of the necessity for planning and making sure that their event is safe.
All the legislative committee members say they're very pleased with how the agencies have handled the regulations this year. Cherry says he expects the committee's recommendation to pass through the General Assembly with, at most, minor tweaks. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith.
A man and woman say they're sorry for allowing dozens of cats to get out of control and overrun two houses they rented in Fort Wayne, leading to thousands of dollars in damage. WBOY's Liberty Stump has more.
An Allen County judge on Monday sentenced 50-year-old Constance Anderson and 45-year-old Jeffrey Turney to 18 months in prison on felony charges of criminal mischief. While Anderson and Turney apologized, prosecutor Karen Richards pointed out animal care workers had to euthanize nearly 100 ill cats that couldn't be adopted. Officials say the houses were filled with cat feces and urine, and one was condemned. The judge ordered Anderson and Turney to pay nearly $50,000 in restitution to the house owners and city agencies. For WBOI News, I'm Liberty Stump.
Indiana officials say the state's plans to extend Interstate 69 between Bloomington and Martinsville could cost taxpayers almost $100 million more than expected. WBOI's Sarah D'Elia has more.
The Indianapolis Star reports an environmental impact statement shows the 21-mile stretch between Bloomington and Martinsville could cost between $500 million and $546 million. The state estimated the cost last year at between $405 million and $440 million. NDOT spokesman Will Wingfield said last year's figures stemmed from a 2000 study and attributed the increase to inflation. State officials need to take or buy 346 acres, including residences, businesses, and a church, to complete the section. It's unclear how the state will fund the work. Most of the $3.8 billion received from the 75-year lease of the Indiana Toll Road has been spent or allocated. For WBOI News, I'm Sarah D'Elia.
And now back to Midday Matters with your host, Sarah D'Elia.
Welcome back to Health 360 here on WBOY 89.1 FM. The time is 12:34. If you'd like to join today's conversation, give us a call at 260-452-1185. You can always email us at middaymatters@nipr.fm or post on our Facebook page. I'm Sarah D'Elia, and I'm joined by my new co-host, who's going to introduce our next segment, Dr. Peter Rothman.
Yes, and today we're going to be talking about night terrors and nightmares, and we'll be interviewing Dr. Atiyah Khan, who is a neurologist and sleep specialist with the Fort Wayne Neurological Center. Dr. Khan, welcome, and we would like to ask you, what are night terrors and how do they differ from nightmares?
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Night terrors are undesirable behaviors that are seen in sleep, where a child usually will wake up from sleep, appears terrified. What the parents will see is the patient has a blood-curdling scream, appears agitated, appears terrified, the pupils are dilated, the heart is beating really fast, the patient may struggle, may have a lot of movements like running to the door or just sitting up in bed and appearing scared. Parents go in and the child does not recognize the parents. As a matter of fact, what they'll tell you is that I try and wake up the child, and the more I try to wake up the child, the more agitated the child gets. Hmm. The child will have no recollection of it the next day. And usually night terrors occur in the first third of the night. And this is to differentiate from nightmares, which are basically frightening dreams. So something, the emotional content is disturbing, a person may wake up from the nightmare or may recall the next day. And typically nightmares will occur in the second half of the night. When they wake up from sleep, they're totally awake immediately. They're upset because they may have had a dream that they did not like or it was disturbing to them, but they immediately will recognize the parents or recognize the surrounding, will be oriented to where they are.
And they often can describe in detail the dream itself in a nightmare.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, some people can recall every single detail.
Mm. And with the timing of night terrors, usually 90 minutes after the sleep begins, where we're in non-REM sleep and stage 3 or 4, could you describe that to our audience, please?
So I'm glad you brought this up. So when we think of ourselves, you know, human beings, we have 3 state of being. So one state is awake, as hopefully you and I are right now. And then the second state is a non-REM sleep. And the third state is REM sleep. Now, people think sleep, the brain should be resting, the brain should be inactive. Surprisingly, the brain is extremely active in sleep, especially in REM sleep. There are areas of the brain that are so active, even more when compared to the awake state. So sleep architecture is very organized, and it's different at different ages. When we think about sleep, we are awake, then we go into, initially, most of us will start sleep by going into non-REM sleep and then have periods of REM sleep. And most of non-REM sleep occurs in the first third of the night. Now, non-REM sleep is also divided into traditionally 4 stages, 1, 2, 3, and 4. And 3 and 4 is thought of as deep non-REM sleep or slow wave sleep. And this is the sleep, if you wake out of that sleep, then you're totally confused, and it's referred to as sleep drunkenness. Mm. And so when a person goes to sleep, especially in children, there's a concentration of non-REM sleep, slow wave sleep, in the beginning of the night. And what you mentioned about parents saying that, you know, it's like 90 minutes after the child has gone to bed, some patients will have it like clockwork, because the fact that night terrors occurs in slow wave sleep, and most non-REM sleep is concentrated in the first third of the night, the parents will tell you, I put my child to bed at 8, and then it's like clockwork, Dr. Khan. An hour and a half later, the child is up and doing this. As night goes on, you have more and more REM sleep, and then you have longer periods of REM sleep. So most of us will dream or recall our dreams early in the morning, because most REM sleep is in the last third of the night.
And REM stands for rapid eye movement, traditionally.
Traditionally. So how do we recognize that somebody is in REM sleep or non-REM sleep? Because the characteristics of REM sleep, and this may surprise some people, in REM sleep, our body is paralyzed other than eye movement and breathing. Hmm. We do not move the rest of our body because we are paralyzed. This may be nature's way of protecting us from acting out our dreams. So when you are asleep, if you watch a person sleep in REM sleep, what you will see is the body doesn't move, but they have very fast movements in their eyes, and you can perceive that. And you can see your babies do that. You know, when I had said that most of us go to sleep through non-REM sleep, babies are different. So inside the uterus, even before they are born, they have a lot of REM sleep, and they actually go to sleep through REM sleep. And this changes as we get older. Hmm.
Well, what are the possible causes of night terrors? And is there a family predisposition?
So causes, it is so common that you can just say being a child is the cause. Hmm. Almost greater than 80% of children will have night terrors at some point or the other. It's universal across cultures, across different countries. But if a child has it persistently, repeatedly, multiple episodes through the night, and it persists beyond what would you think is a reasonable age, beyond toddler or early childhood, then it can be considered abnormal. And in those cases, one can look at factors that increase the risk of having night terrors. And this can be as simple as sleep deprivation. And what does that mean? Children need so much sleep at night. There's different sleep requirement at different ages. And if they don't get that sleep, then they tend to have more night terrors. Hmm. If they have disrupted sleep, for whatever reason, they're not feeling good, they have fever, they're in pain, they have asthma, they have reflux, or whatever reason, if their sleep is disrupted, then they tend to have more night terrors. That tends to be the commonest cause. Now, I want to bring in that there can be conditions like sleep pathology where you have sleep apnea, and that can disrupt your sleep, and parents don't realize that that is what's disrupting the sleep. And so you treat the sleep apnea, night terrors become much less or disappear.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that when our bodies are in REM sleep, we become paralyzed. Is that when we talk about sleepwalkers? Is their body unable to become paralyzed? Is that what's going on there?
So that's a great question. When children or adults, when we sleepwalk, that's actually in non-REM sleep, not in REM sleep. Mm-hmm. And we refer to that as a confusional arousal. There can be a spectrum of abnormalities that can occur in non-REM sleep. The way we like to think about it in sleep is it's a state dissociation. So in sleep, you should be lying down, should not be moving about. You should be not talking, not doing things that are considered normal wake phenomena. Mm-hmm. People say, well, how does it happen?
Yeah.
You know, we think about the brain controlling movement, but it's a very complex structure. There are structures in the brain, which I would say cortical structures that control movements, and then there are subcortical structures. And that, we refer to them as central pattern generators. And so even if your brain is asleep or not working, you can still do complex motor movements controlled by structures below the brain. And, since this is Halloween, I think I can mention this. People have heard about on the farm, on the barnyard animal, if you cut off like the chicken's head mm-hmm. and the chicken is running around the farm, mm-hmm. A chicken with a head cut off. Mm-hmm. Well, that's because this central pattern generators and the subcortical structure is controlling that movement.
Wow.
So when you think about sleep and sleepwalking, your brain may be asleep. And if you have EEG, which controls your, checks your brain waves, you'll see that the brain is asleep, but the person's walking around doing complex things, going to the bathroom, or, as parents tell me, walking to the living room and thinking they're in the bathroom and peeing on the floor.
No.
And again, sleepwalking is another in the same confusional arousal category mm-hmm. where people can do complex things. It's like sleepwalk, sleep talk.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Khan pointed out that with a night terror, not only can there be thrashing and movement, but there can be sleepwalking. And there are certain things that you have to safety proof the house. And you had some ideas on that too.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, parents say, well, you said it's so common. Do we need to look into it? And what people say is you really don't. Practice good sleep hygiene measures. If it's a problem, and if it's a problem for the child, for example, the child is doing it so much, the child could get hurt.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard of people who sleepwalk and have tried to climb out of third-story windows, but that's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Or I've had patients who have walked out of the door and are found on the highway. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a problem. They could get hurt because they're really asleep.
Mm-hmm.
It's a problem if it happens repeatedly, multiple times a day, or rather night, or multiple times a month. That's a problem. It's a problem if the rest of the family is so disrupted that parents are exhausted and they cannot function at work. Then it's a problem.
Right.
So otherwise, reassurance, telling the parents you're going to outgrow it, that's all fine. But if somebody can get hurt, then measures one should take is, number one, make your house safe. The person is really not responsible for their actions, so make sure the knives are put away, the guns are put away, the doors are locked, basement doors are locked. Try and put the bedroom on the ground floor if you think your child's going to try and climb out of the window. There have been cases where people have actually climbed out.
Wow.
Now, for older folks who have behaviors like this of confusional arousal, a very common precipitator is substance or alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And in those cases, I would say if you know you are predisposed, stay away from alcohol. I've had cases and it becomes a legal case. Police gets involved where adults have done activities and they clearly were sleepwalking, but now they're responsible for that action. Mm-hmm. I've had patients who tried to harm someone, choke someone else in the house, and they weren't aware of what they were doing.
Wow.
When the situation becomes so severe that it's disrupting the individual's life and the life of the family around them and they seek medical help, what type of diagnostic workup do you do and then what tests are ordered?
So I think the first thing one has to do is take a good history because you want to be sure that you're really dealing with night terrors or nightmares or confusional arousal like sleepwalking. There can be other medical conditions that can look like that, but it would be treated completely differently. Mm-hmm. An example would be seizures, particularly seizures coming from the front part of the brain, where you can have very complex motor activity. It does not necessarily look like a tonic-clonic seizure or grand mal seizure as we think of. So what I will tell families nowadays, almost everyone has a cell phone with a video camera. Or they have a camera, video camera, and I'll tell them, if you can, tape an event for me. Tape a typical event, because if I look at it, sometimes I know exactly what it is. Mm. The second thing is history. A description sometimes is so clear-cut, and then if it's a clear-cut night terror and a toddler, we can just reassure you don't need any more workup. Mm-hmm. You know, if it's occurring once in a while. In some cases, we will do a sleep study. As I mentioned, if it's recurrent, it's very disruptive, I'm concerned about the safety of the person, typically, we will do a sleep study, and you want to be sure you go to someone who knows parasomnias, which is what we call these disorders, because it may not be the standard sleep study. When we do sleep study, we look at breathing, we look at brain waves, we look at muscle activity, and once I know exactly what I'm looking for, I may ask for extra brainwave leads or EEG leads. I may ask for extra muscle leads or EMG leads, because I'm thinking that the person is moving inappropriately when they should be paralyzed. Mm. So knowing what I'm doing, having a video camera with the sleep study is extremely important. And most of all, having a technician watch them is important. Mm-hmm. With this, I want to rule out conditions that could mimic a disorder. I also want to rule out conditions that can disrupt sleep. For example, sleep apnea, or when you don't breathe in sleep, then your brain wakes you up to breathe, and it wakes you up partially, doesn't wake you up fully. And now you start doing complex movements because your brain is partially awake.
Right. 260-452-1185 or email us at middaymatters@nipr.fm to get in touch with us. We're talking about sleep disorders, the second half of Health 360. And to do that, we have Dr. Khan, who's a neurologist here in Fort Wayne. I wanted to ask, a lot of debate seems to be going on back and forth between, do you wake this person if they are moving and maybe they haven't caused harm to themselves? Maybe they're just walking around and they're going to go back to sleep, or maybe they are causing harm to someone or themselves. How do you wake them, and should you wake them?
So for confusional arousal or night terrors, parents will tell you, the more I try to wake them up, the worse it gets. Mm-hmm. So the best is, don't try and wake them up. Just gently lead them back to sleep, cover them up, you know, be there, reassuring if they're partially awake, and then just let them sleep. Mm. Because chances are you will not be able to fully arouse them. It will take you a long time and will escalate matters and make things worse. Now, this is completely different from nightmare. Mm. Usually with a nightmare, the person will wake up on their own. So you reassure them and then put them back to sleep.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And with sleepwalking, if somebody's just a sleepwalker, should you just let them go around the living room once and then go back to bed, or?
Probably leading them back to their bed is the best thing to do.
Okay.
Rather than try and wake them up.
Okay.
I'd want to add sleep apnea as a possible cause of sleep disruption in small children, enlarged adenoids and tonsils can sometimes be a cause of this. Have you encountered night terrors in individuals who proved to have an abnormal sleep study in small children where it was the adenoids and tonsils, and with that resolved surgically, did the night terrors improve? Have you run into that?
Absolutely. You make a great point. When I see patients who come in, especially when they have recurrent arousals from sleep, that's one of the things I'm looking for. And parents may not have realized that the child has sleep apnea. They may not snore very loudly. They may tell me that they have very restless sleep, or the sleep with their mouth open, or they're all over the place, but they may not have realized this. And so in a child who does this recurrently, a sleep study very often will show that they have sleep apnea. We get them surgically treated or do other measures to treat the sleep apnea, and then night terrors dramatically decrease or completely disappear.
And generally, they say night terrors in children do seem to improve during the adolescent years. Do you find that?
Oh, yes. So, as I said, it's a very common phenomenon, and it will almost invariably decrease and disappear. Now, the spectrum of confusional arousal may persist, and patients may continue to have some sleepwalking. But again, usually the peak for these things is about age 11, and after that it seems to decrease in teenagers and almost disappear in adulthood. Now, I want to bring about something else. Now, if you have an adult who has behaviors like this, they may warrant investigations. Sarah made the point about paralysis. So in REM sleep, you expect the body to be paralyzed. Mm-hmm. Now, this paralysis comes from a part of our brain called the pons, and there's an area called locus coeruleus, and it's around that area paralysis is determined. So they've done this experimentally in cats, where if you make a lesion in that area, the cats start acting out their dreams. And in humans, if that particular area is involved, then patients can lose the paralysis in sleep. Now, this usually doesn't happen in children. This is usually seen in elderly, particularly elderly men. But sometimes, you don't get this clear history, and you will hear spouses tell you that my husband acts out his dream and mm-hmm. he is hitting me in sleep. And, sometimes they'll cover up. They think the husband did it deliberately and it's spousal abuse. The husband didn't do it deliberately. He has lost the paralysis of REM sleep and starts acting out his dream. So if this starts in adulthood, especially if it starts in 40s or 50s, mm-hmm. this is a condition we should really investigate. We may want to do an MRI because some of these conditions are associated with Parkinson's disease.
Oh, interesting. We actually have a caller, Sean, on line one, who has a question about sleep paralysis. Sean, welcome to Midday Matters.
Hi, thank you. I've kind of got the opposite of walking in my sleep. It started about 5 or 6 years ago. It's been seeming to happen more frequently here lately. And it's where I wake up and I'm awake, but I can't move. I'm completely paralyzed. I can't scream for my wife. My vocal cords seem to be paralyzed. And I know I'm trying to scream, and I just have to wait until my body releases. Mm. And,
yeah. So, Sean,
it's very, very, very scary. It scares the heck out of me when it happens.
What you describe is out of a textbook. This is called sleep paralysis. It can be seen in normal people. It's actually quite common. 50% of adults have experienced it at some time or the other. Some people tend to have it more than others. And what sleep paralysis is exactly what you described. You wake up, and for a few minutes, you can't move at all. You're petrified mm-hmm. that you might even die, and then you can move. So sleep paralysis actually occurs, Sean, more in people who have disrupted sleep or they have irregular hours. Do you do that?
No, I have regular hours. It used to be when it started, I used to have different hours, but for the last couple of years, I've been on a regular sleep cycle and go to bed around the same time every night. And it just seems like even now that's happening, it doesn't happen all the time, but I would say it probably happens 3 to 4 times a year.
Are your episodes following a nightmare?
I don't think so. I mean, more than anything else, actually, and maybe you can, a couple of the times I'm awake, but it's almost like I see hallucinations, like a dark figure or like a light or something like that when I first awake. So it's like, I don't know if I'm still half in a dream state, but I know I'm awake and I can't scream and I can't do anything.
Sure.
And then my body finally releases and I can get up and I'm just shaking, you know?
Sure. Sean, sleep paralysis is also seen as part of narcolepsy. Although not every patient who has narcolepsy will have sleep paralysis. But one thing I can reassure you, even though you're scared, people, get out of it. There's no case of someone not coming out of it. And then it's a very normal phenomena.
Now, you said narcolepsy. Now, I do have a problem. Like, I go to bed every night, but I do have a problem falling asleep. Is that part of that? I mean, it takes me a couple hours once I'm in bed to even fall asleep.
So narcolepsy is a condition in which people have excessive daytime sleepiness. They just feel sleepy, and some people think of it as coming as attacks of sleep, but they just feel sleepy at night. That's the commonest symptom in narcolepsy, but they have other conditions in association, something called cataplexy, where their muscles suddenly become paralyzed, especially in response to an emotional stimulus like joke or feeling sad. Then they can have sleep paralysis. They can have what's called hypnagogic hallucinations. So they're awake, but they're hallucinating.
Yeah.
And you know, if you don't have sleepiness, then I don't think you have narcolepsy. But just having isolated sleep paralysis is also a very common finding. And, you know, I don't think you should be very scared, but, yeah, it can be seen.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Yeah, you know, I just kind of get scared. Well, it's more scared that I'm paralyzed than anything else.
Right,
then,
sure.
You know, not knowing if it's, because I've never heard of anybody having that before. Mm-hmm. You know, it's feeling like, was there something wrong with me that,
right,
you know, this is happening?
And the best thing probably if you are so scared about it is to see a doctor is what I, Dr. Khan, what would you suggest?
Absolutely. You know, I'd be happy to see Sean.
Well, I may have to set an appointment.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Sean.
Thank you.
Okay, in summary, Dr. Khan basically pointed out for small children, the best treatment is reassurance. But for adults with these issues, sometimes you do use medications. And when do you decide to use the benzodiazepine-type medications and under what circumstances?
So again, as I said, when I'm concerned about the patient's safety, I've had cases where, you know, a very interesting patient who told me that, you know, he would have this and he didn't think anything of it because he had never got into legal trouble. But it was only when he got into legal trouble where he hurt someone that he sought medical help. And then I wish he had come to me before so we could have helped him with medications. Another situation might be where we have investigated there is nothing else to treat, but the family is so disrupted by this happening repeatedly, the parents can't get any sleep. I may, in rare instances, use medications there. Now, for medications for nightmares, usually these are not used. And I do want to mention that certain medications can increase your risk of having nightmares. Since nightmares tend to be a REM or rapid eye movement sleep phenomena, there are medications that can suppress REM and put a person in a deeper sleep. And sometimes in rare instances, we will use that. I do want to mention that patients who have repeated nightmares of the same type may have post-traumatic stress disorder, and they're getting counseling or cognitive behavioral therapy or getting psychotherapy is very helpful. And actually treating the depression and anxiety that goes along with post-traumatic stress disorder is very helpful. There is something called dream imagery or lucid dreaming, which, you know, sounds a lot like hocus pocus, but it works. Mm-hmm. And here, if you have the same nightmare every night, then you can predetermine the end of the nightmare, and then it's not so bad. And what do I mean by that? So let's say I'm a child, and I'm being chased every night, and it's the same, you know, I have the feeling I'll get caught, and I'm running and running and running. I'm really scared. And then, you know, before I go to sleep, and some people are so scared that they don't want to go to sleep because mm-hmm. they know they'll have that nightmare. Well, just before you go to sleep, you determine the end of the dream. Huh. So, you know, I'm going to be running, and, you know, somebody's chasing me, and then I'm caught, mm-hmm. and it turns out it was my dad. So I don't have to be so scared.
We have less than a minute left, but how can folks get a hold of you if they would like to get in touch?
I work for Fort Wayne Neurological Center, mm-hmm. and you can call and say that you want to see Dr. Khan for a sleep issue.
Okay, great.
And I'll be happy to see
them. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
This is Northeast Indiana Public Radio broadcasting from the Madge Rothschild Studios at 89.1 HD Channel 1. We're streaming online at nipr.fm. This is WBOY Fort Wayne. Thanks so much to all of our guests who were a part of today's show, as well as all of our callers. Thank you so much. Hope you have a good and safe Halloween. If you'd like to follow what we're doing here at WBOY and at Midday Matters, go to our Facebook page and you can hear more and keep the conversation going. This is WBOY Fort Wayne, and Fresh Air is up next.